You're listening to Michelle Redfern and Mel Butcher on Lead to Soar, bringing you the best leadership advice and mentorship from around the world. Learn more at leadtosoar.com.
You're listening to Lead to Soar. I'm your host, Mel Butcher, and I'm joined today by author and politician Mary Chung Hayashi. Mary is a former California State Assemblywoman, an ally of equity, and a staunch supporter of seeing more women enter politics. Her book, Women in Politics, was published October 25th, 2023, and can be ordered from all major booksellers. Mary, welcome to Lead to Soar.
Hi, Mel. Thank you so much for having me. I am thrilled to join you today.
Well, we are so excited to talk with you because a lot of times on Lead to Soar, when politics comes up, it's the workplace politics we're talking about. And of course, there's a lot of crossover in your world, but this is another area where we want to see more women step up and lead. So thank you for writing this book.
Oh, thank you. You're very kind.
I want to ask you some questions about your experience coming to the United States. You wrote that the Korean population in the United States increased from 11,000 in 1960 to 290,000 in 1980. So we weren't alone, but it often felt that way. Could you just tell us a little bit about your experience immigrating from Korea to the U.S.?
Well, of course. And when my parents chose Orange County of California, of all the places, because I think most of Korean Americans at that time were living in places like Los Angeles. Orange County is, and I think it's very different now, but at that time when we moved here, people called me Connie Chung because they have never seen another Asian person other than Connie, who was on television. So we had difficulty sort of adjusting because we didn't speak the language and we wanted to fit in, and everybody wants to belong somewhere. But I think the language barrier and just coming to this country without any orientation or training about what the cultural differences will be like was extremely difficult. I was 12 years old at the time, and that same year, 6 months prior to coming to this country, I lost my older sister to suicide. And we weren't really allowed to talk about that in our family because my parents just sort of got rid of all her belongings and the photos and just made sure she wasn't part of our conversation. So transitioning from a girl in Korea who had just lost her older sister to suicide and then coming here 6 months after and moving to Orange County, I think it was a very difficult transition. And at the same time, they had this expectation of me where good girl training, I call that sort of a, I think this is something that all women can relate to, but the Korean good girl training meant I go to school long enough to find a suitable husband, and then I marry and then have children. And that was the expectation of my parents. And so I went along and I went to Cal State Long Beach when I turned 18. My parents weren't really interested in me getting, you know, education. I mean, they were like, maybe you should find a husband before you turn like 21, you know, before you get really old and you should get married. And I was like, well, maybe I want to do something else with my life. I mean, I got good grades and my friends in high school who didn't do well as I did, I mean, they went on to four-year universities. It's like, why can't I do that? And my parents would say, well, you would be better off if you found somebody wealthy enough to take care of you and get married and have like four kids. I mean, that was really the expectation. So I know you asked about my experience in immigrating to the United States, but in summary, that was sort of my life coming here at 12 and 4 years later, I'm ready to go to college. And already there's like friction between me and my parents. I want to go to college. No, you don't have to go to college. So I hope that gives you kind of a picture of what I went through as a child.
Yeah, well, there's so many layers here. And I got the impression that part of this Asian women's health, this cause that you're really interested in, that had something to do with your interest in going into politics, didn't it?
Oh, yes, of course.
Okay. So I'd like to ask you to tell us a little bit more about your sister, Bo Yoon, and what did you love most about her? And when you reflect now, what would you say was really happening for her?
We just weren't aware that she was suffering from depression. And I mean, I was 12 years old, so I was in no position to diagnose anyone, really. But I would say there were some signs, although it's just hard for me to say specifically if there were any like magical moments where, this is it. Or I mean, I just don't have that kind of reference. But when we were kids, we loved, my sister and I would go ice skating in the wintertime. We weren't allowed to do that in the river, because the river gets frozen over. It's so cold, but it's so dangerous, and like kids can die. And so we were not allowed to go. But my sister and I would, you know, not tell our parents and just go ice skate. And we'll just like, I just have this like image of her like just skating like really fast. And she was taller than me. She was older than me. She was 4 years older than me. So she was like so much better at it. So that's kind of the image I have of her. And like a lot of this, I think, sort of day-to-day experience leading up to her death, you know, I don't have a lot of memories of her being depressed or like struggling. I just didn't know. But the day that she passed away, she did tell me in the morning that she had taken some pills, sleeping pills or something like that. But, you know, we were, the good girl training in our culture requires that you don't divulge secrets. If you tell me, don't tell anyone, I will take that to my grave. And that was sort of our training. So when my sister said, don't tell dad that I took these pills, I was like, well, of course not. So I think there's a lot to unpack there, but when I got older and finished college and just wanted to do something with my life, I really wanted to dedicate my career solving this problem. Why aren't people with mental illness not asking for help? You know, what is the stigma about? How do we break down those stigma? Why do Asian women in the United States, Japanese American women, senior, older Japanese American women had the highest suicide rate in the 90s. And nobody's talking about that, and certainly not in the Asian American community. So I really wanted to work on that issue and ended up starting my own organization to address that. Mm. It was hugely successful. I had incredible support. I mean, we entered into this national partnership with the Centers for Disease Control Prevention to work on depression issues targeting Asian American women. And then later met a legislator who was very much dedicated to mental health issues. And after working for him, I thought, you know, I can do that. I can really make a difference at that level. And so that's, yes, my sister's death, while I don't have a very clear picture of why she took her own life, I really wanted to just dedicate myself to solving that problem. And that's like everything, not just politics, but my nonprofit advocacy and everything I've done throughout my career really goes back to that experience.
What do more people need to understand about the needs for Asian women's health?
Well, I think that I talked a little bit about this in the racial barriers or racial bias chapter in my book, in the new book, but there's this model minority myth where people have the stereotype of Asian Americans as very successful, healthy, model minority. So then we get overlooked. They don't think of Asian American women needing assistance in certain education, awareness, or health programs. And so one of the studies that I talk about in my book that I worked on is tobacco use in the Asian American community, because in the early 1990s, the federal government said Asian Americans do not have high rates of smoking. And I thought, well, that's strange, because just intuitively, when you go to Chinatown, you see a lot of people smoking. And so when I looked into this survey, this is a national survey done by federal government, they used that survey to allocate funding for public health programs, a very important study. Well, they only surveyed English-speaking Asian Americans. And so I went to American Cancer Society and said, can you give me some money so I can do a study in different Asian languages? And the Cancer Society said, you know what? This sounds amazing. I've never even thought about this. And I still joke with them. One of the friends who helped me was also at Kaiser Permanente. They also contributed to that study. And I recently saw her and I said, I can't believe you gave me money. I was like 26 years old. I didn't know anything. Why did you trust me? You know, but I got $75,000 and did a national survey in Chinese, Korean, and Vietnamese. And guess what? I mean, we saw 30 to 40% rates of smoking among that population. And we released that to CDC and got a huge press around it. And so the federal government had to change the way they collect data on Asian Americans with respect to public health because of that study. When I accomplished that, I was just hooked. I said, I need to do this for every Asian population out there. And so many people would say, well, Asians don't really have health problems. And I think that stereotype of model minority, us being model minority, really hurts us when it comes to receiving public awareness campaigns and education opportunities and just support. There's a lot of support out there for breast cancer and those type of issues. And we're really not thought of. We're that invisible population.
I think this is a really nice segue for us to talk about why it's important for more women to go into politics. And there's a lot of reasons. And one of the ones that you mentioned in the book, I feel silly that it hadn't occurred to me in these terms before, but essentially that women as politicians are more likely to author and sponsor bills that are kind of for the greater good, right? Just like what you just talked about. So help us understand from some different viewpoints what you've seen. Why is it important for more women to enter into politics?
Yes. I mean, you just articulated it. It's like 100% perfect. But one of the goals of writing this book is to inspire other women to write their own life path. And to see that we don't have to be controlled by our backgrounds or family history or ethnicities or language barriers. And that was one of the goals. Just to back up a little bit, I don't particularly enjoy writing. I'm not a professional author. But this is my second book. And I think the reason why I'm so drawn to publishing is because when I was 19 years old, I took a women's studies course at Cal State Long Beach, and I didn't know what it was. I thought it was something like, oh, home economics, or it will help me become like a better woman to my husband. So I took this class, and I read about Gloria Steinem, and I read about Jane Eyre. I read these amazing feminist literature, American feminist literature, and that's what inspired me to pursue my own path. And so I think that's why I keep wanting to write, because I want other women to experience what I did by reading feminist literature. And so when I decided to write this book, one of the questions I wanted to answer in writing, because there are a lot of studies to back this up, but I also wanted to interview women and to bring real life examples to show other women that it's possible. And Dr. Edelman said this, you can't be what you can't see. So I thought, well, I need to show specific examples of successes by these women who overcome incredible challenges. So one of the first questions I asked was, well, why do women run? What's their motivation? And it was truly amazing, just the diversity in answers, why they ran. But one common theme is that women run to solve problems. And this is a huge gender difference because, and I'm not saying men do not, but there's a big difference between men running to seek leadership position, which is often their motivation for running. Women, their first answer is that there's a particular problem that they want to solve. They want to increase mental health access. They want to do something about gun violence in schools. They're tired of violence against women. And if you look at all the groundbreaking legislation and women's rights, who championed them? Patricia Schroeder, and I love her quote in my book because she was one of the first women to serve on Armed Forces Committee in Congress. And before she challenged the Department of Navy, women pilots were not allowed to fight in combat. But now we have that. And she made that happen. So there's a direct correlation between more women serving in government and better government and truly addressing those underserved communities. And women legislators tend to work on issues that have no paid lobbyists, child welfare, homelessness, mental illness. I mean, there's just a lot of public policy issues that these women championed because they were willing to run and serve. And so, yes, there's a big difference. I don't know if you want to hear this, but there's a funny quote that Willie Brown, he was sort of a big political figure in California politics. He was the speaker for a long time, and he ended up running for mayor of San Francisco after the term limit passed, and he was term limited out of the legislature. And then this is in his book. He said that serving in public office was like an addiction. That was his quote. And that it's really powerful, and you just got to have it. It's very addicting, and you got to have it, even if it means you're going backwards in terms of like the level of position. He's just got to have it. I mean, can you imagine if a woman candidate said that? And he actually wrote this in a book. Like,
right. Wow.
It's like, oh, this is man we should celebrate. You know? So there's a huge gender difference in terms of the motivation for running. And I just think it's just remarkable that women continue to run for office despite all the challenges and barriers. But that's sort of a summary of the answer to the question. So
I want to read a couple quotes from your book. You, of course, cite a bunch of different studies and resources. So I want to just juxtapose these two things. It says, "Men rule, the continued underrepresentation of women in U.S. politics. Jennifer Lawless and Richard Fox found that men were almost 60% more likely than women to assess themselves as very qualified to run for office." And later in the book, the authors of a study published in the American Journal of Political Science found that Congresswomen secure roughly 9% more spending from federal discretionary programs than congressmen. They also found that women sponsor and co-sponsor significantly more legislation than their male counterparts. So this speaks to something that we've talked about in Lead to Soar, where there's a gentleman who is an organizational psychologist that talks about why so many incompetent men make it to leadership. And at the beginning of his TED talk, he says, "It turns out a good way to convince others of your leadership capabilities is to essentially delude yourself first." So there's so many layers to this that we're talking about, the motivation for who enters politics, what they're personally motivated by, how they assess their own readiness, etc. So let's have a chat for a minute about your early experience when you decided that you want to run for office, and perhaps someone around you or some people around you thought that you weren't quite ready. Tell us about how that manifested for you and how that actually manifests for many women out there who seek to run for office.
Yeah, thank you. That's one of my favorite studies because I think it sums up very nicely where we're at right now. So when my first assembly race, I ran against a man, very well-respected county fire chief. And he was a firefighter for, you know, most of his life and was appointed to serve as the fire chief. And he's never ran for anything either. And I never ran for anything either. I mean, I did a lot of campaign and nonprofit advocacy, but certainly I've never candidate before. But I was so proud of myself. I thought, I have Tipper Gore's endorsement. And I was just so pumped up. And I reached out to my local county party chair, a woman, and we visited, and I told her I just rolled out all these endorsements. I had Kamala Harris endorsement at the time, and I was like, well, what do you think? I have labor, I have SEIU, and she was quiet. She didn't make eye contact with me, and she said, you know, we really need some more talent on our local hospital board. Given your healthcare background, have you thought of that? And I thought, oh, that would be amazing too, but this is what I'm doing. And look, again, I was like, I have Tipper Gore, you know? And she's endorsed me and she's gave me like max out check. And what do you think? She's going to campaign for me because of all the work that I've done in mental health. She says, well, but you don't have any campaign experience and you probably can't win. So that's when my attitude changed, you know, and I mean, back then I was just so naive too. I just didn't know anything. And I probably shouldn't have responded this way, but I said to her, I go, have you asked the man the same question? And she didn't answer that. And he was just celebrated as somebody who was born and raised in Alameda County. I mean, that was in his bio, born and raised. And I said, this is not right. So like, I'm an immigrant and it's born and raised is not a qualification really for public office, but nobody challenged him. Everybody thought he would be the best. I didn't get any of the press editorial support. I didn't, and the county party didn't support me, but I was just like more motivated. And many of us who are in leadership, we sort of have that, oh, if somebody tells me I can't do it, like I'm going to do it more. And Lauren Book, the Florida state senator who I interviewed, she ran for leadership because one of the men said, you just had two small children. You just had a twin baby. You can't run for Senate leader position. And so she did it. And it was one of those moments where I just have to win and prove them wrong. And I did win, but it was difficult. And first time campaigns are extremely difficult because you don't really... Back then, Emily's List was not playing in statewide election or state legislative elections. I mean, they were just starting. They give me some help, but we didn't really have infrastructure like that. Like today, we have a lot more. And I mean, I struggled, but that one really stuck with me. And just to sort of circle back to the point that you're raising about qualification gap, and I think LaFonza Butler in the book describes us the best. She said, and I quote, women often start with a place of lack. When I ask somebody, oh, you know, you should run for school board, the common response that I hear is this, oh, but I don't know how to do the fundraising. Oh, I don't have the, you know, I have kids and I don't really have a spouse who can help me. Oh, I'm not experienced enough. Am I qualified? I mean, that's sort of the common response I get. And that's the place that women usually start, is why they're not qualified. And so what I want to say to all the women listening and who are thinking about this is, well, what do you bring? You know, why can't we think about what we bring to the table and the experiences that we do have? And LaFonza talked about, you know, caring for your parents. That's a qualification. I mean, that's hard work. And you have other resources, but you don't really start from there. And women tend to do that. And so the qualification gap that the study makes reference to, and all the women are sort of interviewed, and what I try to summarize in the book is that sometimes it's self-imposed. Sometimes, of course, there are structural barriers. No matter how confident you are, like I was, nobody asked me to run. I wanted to do it. I thought I was all that. And guess what happened? They said I wasn't qualified. So there are those types of barriers. But sometimes we impose qualification gaps on ourselves. I don't know how many women I've talked to over the years who I mentored. I would say, I want you to apply for this job. And they said, well, I don't meet the qualification. Well, the same study that you made reference to talks about men applying for jobs that where they don't fit all the qualifications on the job announcement. If they meet like half, they'll apply. Women, they have to check every single box. And maybe that's why when women win, we have all these amazing results in government, because they are really qualified and skilled and dedicated.
You wrote that representation matters more than just equity. Can you say a little bit about what you mean by that?
Well, I think this is a bipartisan book. I reached out to a lot more Republican women. I was only able to interview 2 out of 17. And I try to focus on the sort of gender parity issue. So the equity issue is, if 50% of the population are women, then we should have 50% women representing us. Women should make up 50% or 52%. I mean, we're so far away from that right now. And we don't have that political parity. We don't have that equity. What I mean by representation matters is that sometimes, like, women voters don't always vote for women candidates. And that's okay. If you can't vote for a woman candidate because of a political affiliation or stance on abortion, it's okay. And that representation matters when you vote for someone who sort of embodies your values. So I try to make that distinction between sort of achieving gender parity. There's a lot of organizations that work to achieve that. What I would like to see is meaningful representation where, you know, we have women leaders who are advocating for women's rights.
Mary, you wrote there's not one single glass ceiling that women in politics need to break through to succeed. In truth, we are faced with numerous barriers blocking our path to power, financial, cultural, racial, and social. So I want to ask you to talk about some of these challenges that women in particular face when they go into politics. And then just for the listeners' benefit, what I'm going to do is bring us back around to we can overcome these barriers and how to move forward. But let's start there. What are some of these sort of challenges that you think about?
I talk about some of the cultural barriers that women experience. I mean, the entire book is about barriers and how to break them down. But there's 3 specific things that I'd like to talk about. The ambition gap. And I just love that. Like I said to you earlier in the beginning of the show, I just love that you guys use that phrase on your website, because ambitious women are penalized. And I think this is very true in the private sector as well, because we are not supposed to seek leadership. We're supposed to seek consensus and not take too much credit for our successes. And I can't believe how much chatter there is about Kamala Harris. And she's just an overqualified woman leader. And everyone seems to be focused on her style. So ambition gap, qualification gap, and likability double standards. I mean, I think, so I try to break them down by those 3 sort of big groups. And then one of the barriers in the book that I discussed throughout is what I call imagination barrier. And I learned this from interviewing Amanda Hunter, the executive director of the Barbara Lee Family Foundation. They focus on helping women get elected to executive level positions. And they conducted this focus group. And they asked the focus group participants to imagine a leader, governor, you know, president. And most of them envisioned a man. So they did this amazing research and gave it a name that, you know, women can't be what they can't see. And there's this imagination barrier among voters and women themselves. This is not just men saying that. So I talk about imagination barrier. I think the financial barrier is real, because when you analyze the political action committee givings, for instance, more dollars to go to men incumbents. I mean, these are just facts. So women tend to raise more smaller dollar donations, whereas men get a bigger size contributions. So I talk about sort of fundraising and financial barriers that women candidates experience. One example that I use in my book is Mayor Karen Bass, who I was actually on her campaign, and her opponent spent $90 million of his own money. And we raised total $8 million, which was very good for a local race. But most of the contributions were average, like $150. And she won, you know. And so those are the examples that I want people to see. Hmm. But yes, it's difficult when you don't have financial backings. But there are examples that you can see and you can overcome them. And then there's some specific challenges for women of color candidates that they experience. They get even less money. So whatever education we're doing in fundraising and supporting more women candidates, the white women are benefiting from that message, not the women of color. So there's a big racial gap in fundraising. And then there's, of course, like role of media and role of social media.
Okay. I want to pause you there and I want to pull on one of the financial things and then come back to the media, because that's like a whole super challenging thing. So you mentioned something in your book about how women candidates are perceived as less well networked and in the context of like your ability to fundraise, right? And I wanted to point this out because this aligns with the research that we've done where people perceive women candidates who are advancing into these higher ranks of leadership as being, on average, less effective at strategic networking. So there's kind of the general idea of networking, like your comfort developing relationships. So there's the general sort of networking, developing relationships within your field, but strategic networking is really about your ability to build relationships, build partnerships with people who can have some kind of influence over something that your organization needs. And I just think it translates entirely to what you pointed out here in the book. So to bring this back for the listeners, this is not a reality. This isn't something that can't be changed, right? This is a skill that you can develop. You have the ability to develop these strategic networks and leverage them, whether it's for your career or for a political office. I wanted to point that out. Then bring us back to this topic of media, because this is an area where there's really a double standard in how men versus women in politics are treated, the things that are written about them, the questions they're asked. Give us a sense of what that looks like.
So the money and the networking piece, actually, I have some suggestions in the mentoring chapter, which is kind of at the end, because I had an incredible mentor, Sally Lieber, who was already in the assembly, who helped me. But I have to say, she was probably the only one who showed me how to actually do it. Like, she will fax me invites. She would bring me to events and she would introduce me to donors. And that was incredible. And so I'm able to do that for other women because Sally showed me how to do that. 15, 20 years ago, when I was doing the nonprofit work, a lot of women of color leaders helped me open doors to foundations. And it's very similar sort of women mentoring other women strategy. And so mentoring is incredibly important in politics. I know it is in the private sector, but in the legislature, for instance, a lot of the people who run for office are the staffers. And so if their boss doesn't support them, then they're going to start out at significant disadvantage. So mentoring is critical. In terms of networking and women sort of overcoming fears, I mean, I talk about how when I got my first real job, during the interview, I didn't ask how much I would be getting paid. Because the good girl training, the Korean way, was never to talk about money. Like, you don't ask them, oh God, no. You are lucky if you get something. So you just accept it, whatever the amount is. So when I interviewed for this job at the Asian Law Caucus, I didn't ask. And so the human resources manager said, well, we're going to give you, you know, this much per hour plus like benefits. Is that okay with you? I just put my head down like this. And I said, of course, thank you so much. Because we were taught to be grateful for anything. And so think about that behavior in the political setting where I have to make cold calls. I have to call people, men mostly, asking for money. And I don't know what it's like sort of in the Republican women's circles. I assume it's very similar. But when I was running, if you're a Democrat, labor unions, for example, had the most significant amount of resources. And they were all men. I would go into interviews, firefighters, all men. A CIU leadership at the time. I mean, it's more diversified now, but the building trades union leadership. And so I sort of felt like, wow, I wonder if they're going to like me or if they're going to like my male opponent better, just because maybe they can connect better. So I became like more insecure. Like the more I did fundraising, I became more insecure about my ability to win these endorsements. And thank God I won some. I mean, I had the firefighters endorsement. I worked really, really hard. And I think the only powerful union that were predominantly women were teachers and possibly the nurses. And they were pretty influential and both early supporters. So, you know, I felt comfortable. The panel is, you know, 10 women teachers. And I'm thinking, oh, this is great. You know, I go into building trades and it's 10 older white male. I'm thinking, oh, I feel a little insecure. And it's just a normal thing to experience. But it was incredibly difficult for me. Sometimes my fundraising consultant will be like, I'm not going to be here, but I want you to call this list. And you stay here until like you finish this list. I will sit in that room and I'll just be on my phone. And I'm not making calls because I'm just terrified. My parents would just literally have a heart attack if they ever saw me make cold calls to men asking for money. I mean, that is such bad thing to do. If you're a good girl, you just didn't do stuff like that. So overcoming that cultural barrier for me was very difficult. And then once people responded well, I became excited. And I'm like, you know, I can do this. I can really do this. So that was my personal experience. And I think that women, yes, we do need to work, you know, network, but a lot of it is sort of a systemic problem. It's not really on us sometimes.
Sure.
You know, and I talk about generations of women have been sort of kept out of financial resources. And there are more, you know, man named John than women CEOs in Fortune 500. And it's, you know, a lot of the billionaire women inherited money from their family or spouse. And so there's a lot that we need to sort of overcompensate for because we've been left out of that network. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, mentoring, helping other women, bring others along. You talked earlier about it's not just one moment. And I love that sort of phrase in my book that it's not one magical moment. And that's what I realized. It's constant. I thought, wow, this campaign was really, really hard, but I won. So now I'm going to be respected. Now I'm going to be a legislator and all that. No. Women are not trusted as leaders. So once you get in, there's a different set of barriers. And, oh, I want to be in leadership. Oh, that's not that easy either. And that's kind of what I'm trying to say is that it's never just that one magical moment you think it is. It's a continuation of a personal and professional development journey that you need to recognize that you're responsible for some, but there are these major institutional barriers in the way that we need to break down and that we need to constantly look behind us, see who's coming up and lend a helping hand because that's exactly how we're going to break this down. So that's what that quote is. And I just love that. I wrote it myself and I was just so proud of it.
Yeah. You also referenced an article, The Bitch and the Dits. And it was essentially exploring how two different women, one Democratic, one Republican, were portrayed in popular media. And I have a tendency to think that this is all just steeped in gender bias. So just talk to us a little bit about the phenomenon that we saw there and your personal take and philosophy on just managing that as a woman who is in the public view.
Right. And I'm sorry, you did ask about the media piece earlier, but I tend to go on and on. I warned you about that. You know, just kind of sort of combining those two questions together, this is like the best example that I give. During Karen Bass for mayor's race, our lieutenant governor, our first female lieutenant governor in California, co-hosted like this event for Karen because she's the first woman mayor of Los Angeles. And so it was called Women for Karen Bass. It was just so great. I love women event because of the energy and just, you know, it's just the immediate sort of connections we all make. One of the women in the audience asked Karen this question, what makes you think that you're strong enough to lead Los Angeles? And, you know, and Karen's a pro, she managed it well and it went smoothly. But I just can't help wondering if she was a man, if anybody would even ask that. But the fact that a woman was asking that question also is a good reminder that when we talk about gender bias, we're talking about educating a lot of other people, not just men, but women as well. And another example that I use in the book is that first State of the Union address by President Joe Biden, the next day, nobody was talking about the speech. Nobody was talking about the State of the Union. Everybody was on Kamala Harris's brown outfit. And so when they see women candidates or women leaders, we're often judged by our style over substance. I mean, if that didn't happen, then they would be all over Bernie Sanders, right? Because his style is very different. And they were calling Kamala Harris, oh, she's like, you were in a UPS uniform. We need a fashion police. Her color of the suit blended in with the brown leather chair behind her. This is what they were talking about. And this is what they were saying about the vice president of the United States. And nobody was really talking about how Joe Biden's State of the Union went. That experience sort of made me sad because intuitively we feel like we've come a long way and we've made history. You know, in the last two election cycles, we had a record number of women winning across the state and getting elected governors. And I'm thinking to myself, this is what we're reduced to. We have reduced Kamala Harris to her brown suit. So this is a real problem and one of the challenges that women candidates experience, and it's actually in the likability trap section, is that women, the minute they announce that they're candidates for public office, they actually start at a negative because of the sort of the gender bias in people that women are not supposed to be ambitious. People automatically just become suspicious of the woman's motivation. Oh, why is she running? What is this about? Like, who is she? Where does she come from? So that's why women have to be not only qualified, but they have to be likable. And so when women don't, so the minute they announce, they start a deficit. They have to like compensate and like justify why they're running and who they're about. And we're running because of a good reason, not because we want leadership position, God forbid, or because we're ambitious. And so I think that the media, when the media talks about women's style, which happens a lot, the studies have shown that voters just dislike you, even when it's positive. Like, even if it's negative, positive, neutral, even if you don't say anything, if you mention what she looks like, then the voters think of you in a negative way. And that was one of the studies that I included in there. And it's tough. That's really tough because men, they don't have to worry about that. They don't have to worry about their style. Congresswoman Grace Meng talked about how she took one of her kids to a community event on a Saturday, and somebody, a woman, told her, I didn't vote for you so you could be a babysitter. Whereas a man, when they bring their kids to community events, they're celebrated as a great father who's setting a great example. And so these types of gender biases, and especially in the press, this could really damage the women candidate. And it's very difficult to overcome because Celinda Lake, who I interviewed for the book, said, you literally have seconds to make that first impression. And then it's just hard to overcome. If it's negative, then it's tough for women.
What advice do you have for women who are thinking about running for some type of office? I mean, you talk about in your book, there's a lot of these types of things that kind of, I don't want to say scare women away, but they women weigh the possibility of some of these interactions and decide not to. What would you say to those women?
What I want to convey through this book, and yes, of course, these are very scary things to talk about. And one of the reasons why women don't run is because of social media attacks. And Facebook study proved that Democratic women and minority women get attacked more than Democratic men. So yes, these are real. Gazelle Hale, one of the women I interviewed, she won the primary, but she left the race because her kids were being harassed at school. And so I'm not trying to scare people. I'm just saying these are happening to women. If you look at the data, though, women and men win office pretty at a similar rate. I wouldn't say more men win. I mean, that might have been in the past, but right now, women have a good chance of winning. It's just that we don't have enough women running. We just don't have enough pool. And this data would surprise you because everybody thinks California is progressive and liberal and all of that. But in California, since 1911, when women were first allowed to run for office, there's only been 192 women. And this is out of 4,497 total state legislators, 192. So even though it feels like, wow, we're really moving up in the world, we have a long way to go. And we need to kind of recognize that these barriers do exist. But if you're thinking about running, think about what you bring to the table. Do not start from the place of lack. What am I lacking? But think about what your life experiences taught you and what you would do and what you could do in that role. Number two, studies have shown that women get smaller, on average, smaller donations than men, but they are just as competitive. So, because women work hard, and you may think fundraising could be a big challenge, but you can do it. I mean, if I can do it, seriously, I didn't even ask my employer how much I was going to get paid for a job, and I overcame that. So you can 100% fundraise and do that. If you see somebody that you think will be great for a position, recruitment efforts is the most effective way to get more women into office. Because a lot of women, I mean, it wasn't for me, but a lot of women were asked to run. And I talked about that. Women don't really think of themselves as leaders, or they don't think that they should be ambitious, or they don't really think about it. They think about going into nonprofit, for example. But encouraging other women to run, and this needs to happen kind of more systemic way at these institutions, like party leaders needs to do it, elected officials needs to do it. So it's not sort of on an individual level, but I think that we can definitely make a difference when we recruit women. And always think about mentoring others. You think that you don't know anything, but you'll be surprised. You know a lot. Like, there's a reason why you're interested in this. And so helping somebody else, mentoring, and checking your biases, we all have them, I think will go a long way. And so those are some of the ways that we can overcome, and I think why more women should run, because look at the qualification gap study. Women are absolutely qualified. These are women who are qualified, but only 60% see themselves as qualified. So we need to change that narrative, and we can do that by supporting and calling out the press that does not support women. Because of social media too, women have the ability, without spending a lot of money, we have the ability to campaign and get our message out on social media, a very powerful tool. Yes, we have a lot of problems with social media, but we can definitely use that to our advantage. And so because it doesn't cost a lot to do social media, I feel like that's one avenue that women candidates can use effectively to get their message out and call people out. It's so important to call them out when they say mean things or racist things or whatever on social. But there needs to be sort of a concerted effort at these institutions. Democratic Party certainly has a good platform. They said they want more women of color and all of that. But what would be helpful is if there was sort of a coordinated effort to actually go out and recruit, train, and help and back women of color, for example. Mm-hmm. And so that goes across the board, media organization. I mean, we all have a role to play in determining what the leadership looks like.
Mary, I'd like to invite you to be unabashedly boastful for a moment. What are you most proud of accomplishing in your political career?
It's hard to pinpoint one, because I feel like I have made a lot of contributions. But one thing that I'm really proud of is one of my first legislation in the legislature was creating Office of Suicide Prevention for the state, because until then, nobody did that. And because of my bill, AB 509, California has a Office of Suicide Prevention hotline and resources. And I do feel like all the work that I put in the campaign was worthwhile, because I was able to achieve that. And hopefully this book will encourage other women to write their own path, regardless of their family background or their educational background. Or you don't have to be controlled by your culture. I was the first Korean American woman to get elected to the California State Legislature. And I was thinking that, wow, that's really interesting. But then it totally makes sense. We can't even ask how much we're going to make in a job interview. Who's going to raise money to run? So that totally makes sense to me now, you know? And so reading about these women like me and others in the book, I feel like anybody who really wants to pursue this can, and I hope they will.
This has been such a wonderful discussion. Mary, tell the listeners where they can find you and your new book.
Thank you, Mel. I really enjoyed this, and I want to thank you for doing this podcast and all the wonderful, amazing leadership opportunities for women out there. So thank you, Mel. And my book is available just about everywhere. But the best way to find me is at maryhayashi.com.
Wonderful. That was Mary Chung Hayashi, and her new book, Women in Politics, is available wherever you find books. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Lead to Soar. We sincerely appreciate your honest, positive reviews. You can leave questions at leadtosoar.com for Michelle and Mel to answer on future episodes. Until next time, we hope you'll use what you've learned here and lead to soar.